All right, very good. So I think we can start. This is a gong show session. We will have 7 speakers. 3 of them will be virtual, 4 of them will be in person. We're gonna rotate. It's about 10 minutes plus 2 minutes question each speaker. And we are very happy to start with Ankit Angarwal from University of Amsterdam and ULB Brussels, who's gonna tell us about world identities for near horizon symmetries. Ankit, you have the floor.
Thanks, Luca. I would like to begin by thanking the organizers for giving me this opportunity. And I'm going to talk about world identities for near horizon symmetries. This is something I'm doing with Navagadham. Next slide, please. Okay, so here is a brief introduction and the punchline in case I don't finish. So in the last 9 to 10 years, we have understood that soft theorems can be understood as the world identities for the asymptotic symmetries in asymptotically flat spacetimes. And one can go back and forth between the two. When the black holes are present, there is another interesting boundary, which is the horizon of the black hole. And one can study symmetries near the horizon. And this has also been studied a lot in the last few years, especially in context of the software program to solve information paradox. Next slide, please. So now the question that has not been asked is, what are the world identities associated with these near horizon symmetries, which are analogous to the asymptotic symmetries at null infinity? And we are going to explore this question in the context of Schwarzschild black holes. And what we have been able to prove is an effective soft graviton theorem for scattering processes near the black hole horizon. And we claim that this is the world identity for the near horizon symmetries. Next slide. So let's start with how to go from the BMS symmetries to the soft graviton theorem in the flat space. And we will work in angular momentum basis, which is not usually done. So we start with Einstein-Hilbert action coupled to a scalar field with BMS boundary conditions. One can compute the BMS charge in this case using covariant phase space. And assuming that this symmetry continues to be the symmetry of quantum gravity, at least in the infrared sector, it means that the charge commutes with the S matrix of the quantum gravity theory. And we can, so the commutator of QBMS with the S matrix should be 0. And we sandwich it between some external states. Next slide, please. And when these external states are the momentum eigenstates, we get the well-known Weinberg soft graviton theorem. And so as you may know, that it's a statement that whenever you have a scattering process with a soft graviton, that is a graviton whose energy is going to 0, it can be written as the scattering amplitude of the process without the graviton times a soft factor. But what's not usually appreciated is that this kind of factorization only happens when the external states are the linear momentum eigenstates. It does not happen in the angle if the external states are angular momentum eigenstates. Next slide, please. So when the external states are angular momentum eigenstates, then we label the external states by their energies and the angular momentum quantum numbers L and M. And in that case, one can easily show that this factorization doesn't occur, because if you look at the right-hand side of this equation, there is L prime M prime, and L prime and M prime are summed over. So it's not just a soft factor times the amplitude without the soft graviton. There's some mixing going on. Here C is the related to Clebsch-Gordan coefficients, and it's the integral of the 3 spherical harmonics. Next slide, please. So now the near horizon symmetries. These are the diffeomorphisms that act non-trivially on the horizon. And we are going to focus on the near horizon symmetries that were discussed by Donne, Jiribe, Gonzalez, and Pino. We will refer to them as DGGP. So they showed that near horizon symmetries of of a non-extremal black hole are two copies of super translations plus Virasoro. Next slide. And yeah, we are going to focus on these symmetries. So let's talk about how do we study the near horizon scattering. So we start with Einstein-Hilbert plus minimally coupled scalar field. We study the metric perturbations around the Schwarzschild black background. Since there's a black hole present, there's no special translation symmetry. So we cannot use the momentum eigenstates as the external states because translations are not the symmetry, but there's still rotation symmetry. So that's why angular momentum eigenstates are still good eigenstates. And exploiting this rotational symmetry, we can reduce the problem to a 2D problem where it's a theory with infinitely many Kaluza-Klein client fields, which are massive now, and the mass is due to the angular momentum. Next slide, please. The radiative mode, the graviton, in this 2D theory turns out to be a transverse scalar whose mass is given by this mu, where RS is the Schwarzschild radius and L is the angular momentum quantum number. Scalar field also behaves in the similar way. And then in this 2D theory near the horizon, one can write the Feynman rules. And one of them is this interaction vertex. And from this, you can easily see that why this factorization doesn't work, because now these external states are labeled by L and M. And this, from the addition of angular momentum, we know that these L's don't add up linearly. There's some Clebsch coordinates involved and so on. So that's why the factorization doesn't work. Here, this PJ and PK are the two momenta, and LM are again the angular momentum quantum numbers. Next slide, please. Yeah. Now this is the important part. So since I said that these 2D fields are now going to be massive, so it's important to understand how we define the soft limit. And so let's call the two momentum of this graviton mode to be Q, which is given by Qx. And the second component is mu over Qx. This two metric is off diagonal metric with the entries -1, -1. So you can check that this squares to minus mu square. And what this soft limit means here is that Qx over M Planck is going to zero. At the same time, black hole is very massive as compared to the Planck mass. So mass of the black hole over M Planck is going to infinity. But when we do this, we keep this M hat and Q hat, M hat times Q hat fixed. So that's the soft limit. And in this limit, one can check that the dimensionless Q, which is this two momentum Q over M Planck, this goes to zero. And next slide, please. And with this limit, one can, just as one derives Weinberg's soft theorem in flat space time, one can derive this near horizon soft theorem. And the result is given by this equation. It looks very similar to the flat space Weinberg soft theorem, but and there are a couple of differences. One is this prefactor on the right hand side, which is square root 8 pi g over 8 gm. In the flat space case, it's just square root 8 pi g. Now there's an 8 gm where m is the black hole mass. Another difference is this mu k square over pk, you know, pk in dot q. Mu k square is the mass of the kth hard particle. And these are the dot pk in dot q is the dot of the two momentas. One is the hard particle two momenta and the q is the graviton two momenta. And this is the derivation from the field theory side.
One, you got 1 minute, Ankit. Sorry to interrupt. Okay. 1 minute.
One should also be able to get it from taking the DGGP charge and commuting it with the S matrix, just as we did in the flat space case. this seems to work, but there are a couple of subtleties which are which we are trying to work out currently. Okay, next slide, please. Okay, and the conclusion, we derived soft theorem for the New Horizons scattering, and these seem to be the border entities for the New Horizons symmetries of DGGP. And now the question is, what are the border entities for other near horizon symmetries that have been proposed, and for also other black holes like BTZ and so on? Can there be a border entity without the near horizon soft limit that we found? Is there another way to do it? Is there a connection to the soft hair proposal? And can someone do something similar for the lambda BMS? Another question is there an antipodal matching just as in the case of the flat space time? And that was the question that that made us to start looking at this. I'll stop here. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for Ankit, both in person or virtual? Here, there's a question.
Hi, yes, I think you just briefly commented about that, but how do you implement the analog of the matching condition? Do you have some matching or in the past of the future of the horizon with the...
Yeah, I mean, we don't know the answer, but the expectation is that near the bifurcation surface, past of the future horizon data should match with maybe the future of the past horizon data, maybe for the charge conservation and maybe similar logic holds just as there's near the special infinity.
So you managed to get a wide identity without matching near the bifurcation?
No. So to get the wide identity, you need the matching.
Thanks.
All right, perfect. Other questions for Ankit? Then we can thank him again. Thank you very much. And I'm going to ask Moni Ray to show face to the Zoom link. Perfect. Hello. Hi, Moni Ray. Can you hear us? Can you unmute yourself?
Yes. I mute myself. Do you hear me?
We hear you very well. Thank you. Now, the slide, you should be able to see the slide. And the only thing that I please ask you is that to communicate to us when you want to change slides. Okay? To please tell us to change slides.
Okay.
All right. And then we are all set, we can start. So it's a pleasure to have virtually Monireya Hamadpour from University of Tehran. She's going to tell us about holographic entanglement entropy and mutual information in the form field theories at finite temperature. Please.
First, I want to thank the organizer to let me talk in this conference. And my work is based on the articles we did in collaboration with my advisor, Hajar Ibrahim, to appear on ICAR soon. Please, next slide.
Oops. Monire, you have to unmute yourself. I don't know what happened. You disappear for a moment. Okay. You're back. Please, go ahead.
In motivation part, I will give some definition on T-bar deformation, entanglement entropy, and mutual information briefly. And then I will present our results on holographic entanglement entropy and mutual information. Please, next slide. T-bar deformation is an irrelevant and solvable deformation which was introduced by Zomalek-Chikov and in 2004 for first time, and then in 2018 by Magouf and et al. They claim that T-bar deformation represents a geometric cutoff at finite distance z equals zc in the bulk. which removes the asymptotic region of ADS and places the deformed CFD or new QFD on the new boundary. We consider a TT-bar deformed field theory on a flat manifold, which action satisfies the equation number one. And if you want to calculate X as a general form of TT-bar F deformation in general dimension, which it is calculated by Taylor and Hartman in 2018 and 14, you should use Brown-York stress tensor in the bulk. We will work in the limit of lambda goes to zero, and which gives the dictionary of this duality as equation two, which relates the lambda deformation parameter to the finite cutoff. And our background geometry is asymptotically ADS spacetime in D plus one dimension. Thanks. May you go to the next slide. And another quantity is entanglement entropy, which is a measure of entanglement in a given pure quantum state. You can calculate this quantity in the field theory side using von Neumann entropy, which is given in the left side of this equality. But using RT prescription given by Ryo and Takayanagi in 2006, you can just calculate minimal codimension to space-like surface in the bulk, which gives you the desired holographic entanglement entropy, which that's anchored on the boundary and has the same boundary as region A. Next slide, please. In the case that you have two disjoint regions, intervals, which are not complements of each other, you can use mutual information measuring the correlations, all classical or quantum correlations. It is given by equation five, linear combination of entanglement entropies. As you see, because of this linear combination, it is all UV divergences will cancel, and this quantity remains finite and scheme independent, and also it's all always is positive. For the composite region A, entropy of this composite region A and B, we have two choices. First is when the separation distance between two region A and B named X is much larger than the size of each region L, which gives zero mutual information. In other case, we have a first transition, first order transition to a non-vanishing mutual information when the separation distance is much less than size of the system. For a finite temperature case, dimensionless parameter is a Tx. Next slide, please. Motivating question here is how measures of quantum entanglement are affected by this deformation. In the field theory side, parameters are T, lambda, L, goes for temperature, deformation parameter, and size of the system, which out of these three parameters, we can make two-dimensional parameter T, L, and lambda bar over L. In gravity side, they reads as ZC over Z star and Z star over ZH, which Z star is the turning point of this minimal surface in the bulk. Next slide. After calculating minimal surface, we have equations 6 and 7 for area and legs of entangling region, which have two infinite series. Each one of them handles the thermal limits, and one of them will handle the finite cutoff limits. Our calculation is analytic because we work in general dimension, and our methods are similar to Fisher and Kondo's article. There are three different limits we consider, but case by case. Please, next slide. First limit is after calculating, we see the area law behavior and different expansions parameters like ZSE over ZS is specific to our results. And we have different orders of thermal effects. In each thermal effect, we have an expansion of the finite cutoff case effects. Next slide. This is a special limit just appears in finite cutoff case. It shows area behavior after calculating, and it is a decreasing function of ZSC. Also we see the effect of a finite cutoff case. Next, please. Last one, this entanglement entropy is the high temperature case and low deformation parameter. We see the effect of volume law behavior and different expansion in different powers of ZC over ZH, which in either case of temperature goes to zero or ZC finite cutoff goes to zero, these corrections will disappear. And all the isolated divergences are put in the equation number 30. Next slide, please. Next, I talk on this. Please pass. Next. Using these three different limits of the entanglement entropies, we can calculate non-vanishing mutual informations. First limit is this one, which shows again the effect of ZC over Z star expansions in different powers. And also we have another kind of corrections named X over ZC, which we believe that it is a kind of a geometric progression, which will cancel overall infinite divergent part L over ZC in powers of T minus 2. Please, next slide. Same as the results which will have appear on this limit, again, two type of corrections, X over ZC and correction ZC over ZH, each of them appears and expansions with different powers of these parameters. We have first order phase transition and critical separation X depends on the cutoff, and it is a decreasing function of ZC, and also in the limit of X goes to zero, in contrast to zero cutoff case, we have a finite holographic mutual information. Next, please.
Manire, just to let you know, you have a little bit less than 1 minute.
Okay. And last but not least limit is equation 16. Again, we have same old corrections, X over ZC and ZC over ZH. And isolated part for each disjoint region appears in epsilon L and epsilon 2 L plus X. We believe that divergence is due to the powers of X over ZC will disappear if we write it in the series like geometric progressions. Thanks. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Very good. Thank you very much, Manire. Are there questions? Yes.
Thank you for all the presentation. I was wondering, so you have this finite cutoff version of the holographic entanglement entropy. And I was wondering, have you checked if it satisfies the usual sort of inequalities that such entropy follows?
Sorry,
do you hear me?
I didn't hear the questions so
okay.
Very well.
I will repeat it. Your finite cutoff and holographic entanglement entropy, the HEE that you have obtained, have you
yes.
looked whether or not it satisfies the usual inequalities that entanglement entropies have to satisfy?
Yes, it will satisfy, and also we in the case we checked all the zero temperature case and zero cutoff case, and it satisfies all the subadditivity, strong subadditivity cases.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much. Unless there are other questions, I think we can thank Monire again. Thank you very much. Next, we have, now I have someone I can hit with a hockey stick. Very good. Are you all set? Okay, so
yes.
Let me just introduce you. We have Giovanni Canepa from CPT Marseille. He's gonna talk about classical BV-BFV construction on corners for general relativity, please.
Okay, thank you. So in this talk, I will try to talk about what is BV-BFV, just to give a sketch.
Can you hear me?
Okay. And then I will try to apply it to gravity. We'll see gravity more or less as an example. And the key point is that we'll see that in gravity, but in any field theory, BV will be a description of the field theory and their symmetry, then BFV will be a description of the field theory on the boundary and will describe, for example, the reduced phase space in a cohomological way. And then we will see that on the corner we get Poisson possibly curved algebra. So, first of all, some motivation. Why we care about BV, BFV, and what it is. So the BV formalism is some sort of mathematical tool to deal with field theories with symmetries. And the idea is that when there are symmetries, it's difficult to quantize with the path integral formalism, and with BV, you can overcome some of these difficulties. Then BFV is its counterpart when you work on the boundary, let's say the Hamiltonian counterpart, and then you can extend and get also some structure on corners. So why we care? So as I was saying, BV-BFV is useful for quantizing field theory. And when you have a BV-BFV, that means that you have some notion on the bulk and on the boundary and some compatibility issue and some compatibility condition, sorry. Then we have a quantization scheme. And the other motivation is that already at the classical level, which will be the level on which we will focus on this short talk because of time constraint and because of the fact that with gravity we are not so far in the quantum world. So already in the classical BV setting, we get a cohomological description of the reduced phase space and Poisson structure when you work on corners. So this is the outline of the talk. So we'll give a brief introduction. Then we'll see what is the reduced phase space of gravity in this formalism. And then we will see how a Poisson structure comes out. Here there is a problem on the corner. Sorry. There are at least other two mistakes. So I will not give many motivation, but that's more or less what a BV theory is. So we have a quadrupole where F is a graded manifold. If you're familiar, just infinite dimensional manifold usually with some degree. So it's usually when you have field theories, the space of fields, and you assign a number to each field, and this is the degree. Then this graded manifold should be symplectic. So we have a symplectic form, and we associate it to be of degree minus one. we will see an example of it to understand. And then we want also the physical content, which is encoded in the action, which is a degree zero function. So sorry, it is a zero. And it's a sort of extension of the classical action to this grid setting. And then we also have this, which is a bit redundant, but we have an odd vector field on F, which is the Hamiltonian vector field of S. So Q is given this minus one and zero, this should be of degree one. So as an example, let's see gravity. So here I collected the space of fields, its symplectic form and the action. So I put also some comments. So the space of field of gravity is composed by, classically we have a tetrad E and the connection omega. I'm using Palatini-Cartan gravity. And then to get the BV formulation, you have to add the Gauss encoding the symmetries. In this case, we have the gauge symmetry and the diffeomorphism symmetry here. And then you have to take the cotangent bundle to get a symplectic manifold, as we have seen in the previous hour. So this is the standard Darboux symplectic form. And the action is this one. So this is the BV action. As we can see, there is a classical part here and a new part, which is called BV, in which we encode the symmetries as follows. So we associate, as you can see, this is the gauge symmetry for E. This is the standard diffeomorphism symmetry. And then we associate it to the corresponding antifield, and so on for omega, C, and Xi. All right, so more or less this is the structure of BV theory. And usually you consider a BV theory when you talk about a theory on the bulk. Then you can extend this formalism to a BV or a BFV or a BF squared V, depending on what you consider when you have a manifold with boundary and corners. For example, manifold with boundary, you will have also a BFV theory on the boundary and a BF squared V theory on the corner. In this case, the BFV and BF squared V have the same structure of the BV theory that was written here, but there is a change in the degrees, because in BV, the degree of the symplectic form is minus one, the action has degree zero, and Q has degree one. Then Q stays the same, then here there is a missing F, this is the BFV, as a symplectic form of degree zero that corresponds to the fact that we know that on the boundary, we always have also a classically symplectic structure. Then the action will have degree one, and Q is degree one, yes. On the corner, omega will have degree one, the action will have degree two, and Q of degree one. So some remarks. The first of all is that there is a way of combining all this data together. There should be some compatibility condition between bulk and boundary and corner. This compatibility is not trivial. There are many theories in which this compatibility fails to be satisfied. Gravity is one of those, so some other work has to be done. And the important thing is that if you start from a BV theory in the bulk, it is possible through some procedure to construct a BFV theory on the boundary, just doing some restriction and then some symplectic reduction if it is possible, and then the same to the corner. So now for the last, I don't know how many minutes. Three minutes, perfect. We'll see what is the BFV structure for gravity, so on the boundary, and then on the corner. So remember on the bulk, we had the tetrad, which is still here, and then we had the connection and symmetries, and then we took the cotangent bundle. Now we have the tetrad. Now the point is that this is no longer a trivial cotangent bundle, but will be a principal bundle over some, just a bundle over some base that is written by this. Okay, here there are some technicalities, but the important point here, it can be seen looking at the action, is that the action contains all the information you need to know to construct, to see what is the reduced phase space of the theory, because here, written in red, we have the constraints. You can see E d omega e equal to 0, which is 1, and then E f omega equal to 0, which is here, split here and here. And then, most importantly, the part which have these antifields denoted by a dagger describes the information about bracket between constraints. For example, if you take the constraints of the bracket of this constraint with respect to this symplectic form, but it's just the standard symplectic form of gravity, this is the first part, you will get the commutator between C and C and then E d omega e. And this is the way in which the BFV formalism encodes it. So if you can deduce from BV the BFV, you automatically get all the information about the constraint. So lastly, let me talk for the last minute about what happens on the corner. So on the corner, we can do the same again. And we get, again, a space of fields, a symplectic form, and an action. Now, again, this is somehow complicated. There are some subtleties here that I will not talk about. But the interesting thing is that this action defines automatically a structure of Poisson algebra that can be curved, depending on polarization that we have to choose. So given the BF squared V action, that is something that you get starting from the BFV, you can choose a polarization, then you have some freedom, and get Poisson B vector field that defines a Poisson algebra. Choosing different polarization induce different structure of Poisson algebras. So here are a bit of references, and this one is the one that I was talking about on the last slide with the joint work with Alberto Cattaneo. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You were on time. It's unfortunate I couldn't use the stick. You put it back here. Questions for Giovanni? That. Yes.
Could you explain why the degree goes up as you go down?
Yes.
And the other related question is how your boundary action is related to things like the usual Gibbons-Hawking boundary action.
Okay, so the degrees goes down in using this it's a bit complicated, but basically the degrees are connected through this equation. So if omega goes down or goes up by one, then since Q is one, also S has to go up and go down by one, as you can see here. Now, the point is that they go up because basically the two form on the boundary comes from the variation of the action on the bulk. So, for example, the two form comes from here. So you see 0, 0 or 1, 1. And then the action goes on its way. For the second question, so you were referring to this, right? So basically, what you classify, okay, so this is the Palatini-Cartan, but one can show that you can pick this and bring it to the standard Einstein-Hilbert just with the metric. And the idea is that the classical action should just be this part. So if you use for omega, the standard expression for a spin connection, you gauge fix, you will find the Einstein-Hilbert, the constraint of the Einstein-Hilbert.
But I guess you have the ghost, the Diffeo ghost, contracting the usual Gibbons-Hawking type.
Okay,
term.
Yes. So the ghost, you interpret the ghost just as Lagrange multipliers.
Oh, okay.
If it is. Yeah.
Toss it over.
To you. Okay.
Great. Other questions? Then we can thank Giovanni again. Very good. Next speaker is Virtual. Rukaya, are you there?
Yes, I'm there.
Perfect. Hi, Rukaya, how are you? Thank you for connecting. I know it's a bit late over there, but, but okay. All right.
No, but thank you for everything. I'm sorry not to be there in person, but I hope next time I make it.
There will be occasions, I hope. All right. So we can, I think everything is set. Again, Rukaya, as the other virtual speakers, you will have to tell us to change slide. And we can start. So we're very happy to have Rukaya Dekil from LMU. And she's going to tell us about entanglement in superpositions of spin network states with different graph structures. Please, the floor is yours.
Thank you. So a big thanks for the organizer for taking care of all the details of this conference and also give me the opportunity to talk to you about my work. So it's been a very long project in collaboration with Daniele Ricci and Eugenia Colafranceschi. And next slide, please. And the main motivation behind it is the usual motivation behind any quantum gravity theory. So basically, the different questions that led to physicists to think about quantum gravity models, such as locality problem in space-time, how to make sense of singularities in general relativity, and all the information that we get from black hole physics and the underlying degrees of freedom. Usually, the most mainstream approach for emergent geometry in quantum gravity models is its relation to entanglement, or the proposition that geometry emerges from the quantum property of entanglement at the level of the fundamental degrees of freedom or building blocks. And within this proposal, there is usually the hidden questions of what is the structure of the Hilbert space of the theory, how it is partitioned, because this plays a huge role in entanglement calculations, and what are really the true physical degrees of freedom that are entangled and that carry this property and would eventually give rise to what we call space-time. This leads me to the outline. So we can move to the next slide, please, of my talk. I will present very briefly and schematically the quantum gravity states that we are playing with, move on to build the generic case of a superposition and study the bipartite case. And then I will also briefly mention the entanglement entropy results for this class of states. We can move to the next slide. So the basic states that we usually, or maybe you also stumbled upon in quantum gravity theories that are background independent, are spin network states, which are current quantum gravity states. And these spin network states are basically geometrically a collection of edges and vertices, where these edges and vertices carry quantum labels and quantum information about the underlying fundamental degrees of freedom. And at the quantum level or group theoretic level, to each edge we associate an SU2 reducible representation, and to each vertex we associate an intertwinal, which is the quantum number for reflecting and the invariant map between the representations, or these flux of links coming from all directions. So it's like the invariant map associated to all the edges, meaning at one point at the vertex, as the picture can show. So for example, that's a heuristic picture of a spin network where the vertices are labeled by intertwiners. It can run till D, where the D is the space time dimension, and it's also called the valency of the vertex. And these spin networks, they enjoy some properties. So they are endowed with group theoretic data, which are crucial for the representations and quantization of our geometry. They can be also interpreted as quantized tetrahedra and be glued together to form an extended dimensional triangulation. So we can move to the next slide. So they can be interpreted as quantum tetrahedra in the sense that here I take the example of a four-valent vertex. So in four-dimensional quantum space-time. These links going out or going into the vertex are actually dual to a surface that they, or can be pictorially seen as links piercing a surface uniquely. And if we take four links, which means we take four surfaces pierced by these links, imposing the gauge invariant at the point where they meet, so at the vertex, is equivalent to bringing them all together and closing them, which give rise to a tetrahedron. And from this fundamental building block of the theory, one can form an extended dimension, triangulation, in the sense that we can move to the next slide. One can take, for example, two building blocks or two spin networks. We're still in the same dimension, so four valent vertices. And we can identify spins carrying the same color and gluing them together. So in this geometric picture, this is equivalent to identifying the faces of the corresponding tetrahedra. Starting from such a class of states, one can actually store this kind of information that can govern a larger graph. So this is the simplest case. One can store it in a matrix, usually called in graph theory the adjacency matrix, which tells us the information about vertices that are linked together through a common edge, or they are isolated. So this is the case of a simple building block and for a simple class of states. However, the Hilbert space of the quantum gravity theory is not only two tetrahedra, but is sum over all possible numbers of such atoms of space. We can move to the next slide, please. Thank you. So in models such as group field theory or LQG, etc., one can consider a more generic state, which is not done so far, at the kinematical level of the theory, as a superposition of such states. And in our case, I'm going to focus on the a bipartite system, in the sense that we distinguish region A and B through partitioning degrees of freedom according to this kind of information stored in this adjacency matrix, which we call connectivity pattern. So in each region, we will have superposition of graphs or spin networks that carry different connectivity patterns. And I also stress this, the Hilbert space of the bipartite system will be a tensor product, just to get an idea about the behavior of this proposition of such states. And at this level of the construction, the states are not entangled. So according to the entanglement, the gluing procedure that I previously defined, we should do this by hand, which is present in the next slide. Can we move to the next slide, please? Thank you. And for this kind of a bit sophisticated case, one also go back to graph theory, where there is also a B-adjacency matrix that stores the information of bipartite systems. So it tells you the set of degrees of freedom that are entangled within each graph, and then also the set of degrees of freedom that are jointly entangled between the two regions or partitions of your degrees of freedom, which is stored in this matrix MAB. So A and B are the adjacency matrix within each fusion A and B, and C is the B adjacency matrix that reflects the boundary connectivity. And the procedure is the following. We connect internally each region A and B so that we entangle the superposition within each region. And then we also perform a boundary crossing entanglement, which is a bit sophisticated entanglement because we don't follow the same connectivity pattern, but a class of connectivity pattern that there is a larger category of the respective connectivity pattern in each region A and B. And we end up with an entangled superposition, entangled state and superposition, which is basically a very long Cauchy product of series of superpositions. And we can proceed to compute the entanglement in this case, and we can go to the next slide, please. Thank you. So for the Neumann entropy, there is a crucial distinction between considering graphs, superposition of graphs with different number of vertices or different number of building blocks, and with the same number of different building blocks, but with different connectivity pattern within each state or within each graph. In the case, in the simplest case of different numbers, we have orthogonal states. So the mixed term and the such superposition of states can get canceled, and one end up with an incoherent interference term, which is basically a generalization of the usual entropic calculation for LQG, which is a sum of two terms. The first sum is the classical Shannon entropy of the probability distribution omega, which is the probability of finding a given state with V vertices with definite spins.
Rukaya, sorry to interrupt. You have 1 minute.
Okay, thank you. And the second term is the average entropy at fixed spin with all possible combinatorial patterns that we're considering in superposition. We can go to the next slide. The second more interesting case is when we have the same number of discrete building blocks, but different connectivity patterns within each superposition. So we get the same term from the incoherent interference, and we get an extra term from coming from a quantum information theory, which is called the interaction information, which is already at the kinematic level, and it expresses the amount of information present in any subset of the variables that we are considering in our states, heuristically speaking. So this coherent interference can also give some kind of definition of relative distances, distance measure within the full Hilbert space theory. So we can move on to the next slide, please. The one after. Thank you. So I sketched very briefly the states that we're working on with the general case of superposition. The entropy in this case for a very general tensor product structure of Hilbert space, which gives just the idea that for the superposition of states, we have this kind of extra hidden information we didn't have access to in the usual states. There is a lot of work still to be done, which is to actually study what happens at the boundary of the theory. So at the boundary of this gluing surfaces, since we know from several works done by Laurent Fradel and William Donnelly that actually the physical Hilbert space is embedded into the tensor product of the two Hilbert spaces, and that's what we actually need. The relationship between the superposition of spin networks and S-modes at this level is very crucial, and it can also play a big role in the emergence of geometry from entanglement. The next slide, please. That was at the kinematical level. So there is another part to be done on the dynamical level and how to apply to black hole physics, especially identify the true physical microstates, the entropic calculations and the symmetries. And finally, also some work has to be done to shed more light into the diffeomorphism invariance at the quantum level. Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right. Are there questions? We have time for one question.
Hey. my question has to do with the last part of your presentation, the relation with geometry.
Yeah.
Do you... So I should think about this tetrahedra as building blocks of the space-time, right?
Yeah.
So do you have any relation between a geometric quantity and your entropy, or is it still at the level of representations for the moment? Because, for example, in gravity, we expect a scaling of the entropy with the area or stuff like that. Do you obtain something similar?
Well, we are still I'm still working on the area generalization to the area operator case, so computing the area spectrum in this case, which is basically also related to coarse graining procedures. So it's a bit complicated for the superposition, but it's still work in progress in that perspective. And I think in this case of tensor product Hilbert space, it's not really obvious how to do it like precisely and conceptually right, let's say.
Thank you.
All right, thank you very much. We have to stop. Let's thank Rokaya again. Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Excellent. So next speaker, is the next speaker ready? No, he just lost the mic. So are you going? Try to say something.
Box. Hello.
Now it's working. Maybe. Perfect. So we're very happy to have here Arnaud Delfante from Mons University. He's going to tell us about holographic Lorentz and chiral frames, please.
Yes. Hi, everyone. Do you hear me? Is it fine? Okay. So the title of my talk is holographic Lorentz and chiral frames. And we'll see in a few moments what it means, and it is based on a paper that we published 1 month, 2 months ago with Andrea, Luca, Charles, Marios, and Romain. Okay, so, but first let me make a small introduction and small backgrounds on this talk. So, like many people since the beginning of the 80s, we decided to study the classical phase space of two-dimensional asymptotically anti-de-Sitter AdS gravity, okay? To do that, we will select the allowed metric fluctuations at infinity as discussed in the seminal paper of Buon and Eno in 86. In fact, this choice does not require to fix any particular gauge, but it is often convenient to choose, for example, the two most popular that are Pfefferman-Guam and Bondi gauges. Okay? But in this talk, we propose to abandon these two usual setups and consider a more generally covariant way to discuss this classical phase space, and which has also the advantage to allow for a smooth flat phase limit, and therefore we can make contact with the current efforts to determine an holographic theory of the asymptotically flat space time. Okay, and just a word on the fact that the covariant Bondi gauge that we are going to see in the next slide is originally motivated from fluid gravity correspondence. And we will see at the end of the talk that it will allow us to study holographically Lorentz and chiral frames. Okay, so let's see what is the covariant Bondi gauge. So the KID is that we will relax the ADS Bondi gauge by adding a parameter in the line element which corresponds to the freedom to choose a boundary dyad. And in the fluid gravity language, it corresponds to the freedom that we have to choose relativistic fluid velocity at the boundary. Okay, so we can reconstruct this ADS bulk metric along the null radial coordinate R. Okay, where the conformal boundary is located at R going to infinity. We have also the K, which is the inverse of the ADS radius, so that the flat limit will be reached when K is going to zero. And we have the bulk, the boundary metric that we can express in terms of the one-form Zhu and Saru in the Carlton frame like this, okay? We have also the Weyl connection that is expressed in terms of the one-form like that. And finally, we have also this scalars epsilon and key that we can express, that the rule is clarified by looking at the Einstein equations that will imply on a certain energy momentum tensor that for the simplicity of this slide, I will not show it. And we can obtain these equations from Einstein equations. So by looking at this equation in terms of epsilon key, we will see that they are just the, respectively, the energy density and energy flow on the boundary. Okay, so now that you have the solution space, we can ask what are the bulk diffeomorphisms that will preserve this line element. And this was obtained 2 years ago by my collaborators, where they obtain that they are generated by asymptotic vectors depending on four parameters. Two are contained in the boundary diffeomorphisms, the Xi, as we can see in this general local transformations of the boundary dyad. There is also one contained in sigma that induces Weyl rescalings on the boundary geometry. And the main novelty of the boundary covariant Bondi gauge is the eta. As we can see in this equation, it is it is the Lorentz boost on the infinitesimal version of the Lorentz boost on the boundary dyad. Okay, so the first big message that we have the command of the gauge is that we have a bigger set of residual symmetries. And now we can look if these are real symmetries or not by looking at the symplectic structure that gravity will induce on the asymptotic data. Okay? So by calling with a big J the bulk metric, one can extract from the H10 Hilbert Lagrangian this presymplectic potential. And the second big message is that in the computation of this potential, we will obtain divergent orders in L squared and R1, since we have that the conformal boundary is located at R going to infinity. Okay, but we can use the built-in ambiguities of the presymplectic potential, so the boundary term and the corner term, to cancel these two divergent orders. But then we have a choice of prescription to take for the finite order. And in one case, one can recover the same wages that are obtained in the Pfeffermann-Graham gauge. But remarkably, there exists also a second choice of prescription where we will obtain a presymplectic potential that will remain finite in the flat space limit. And in the following, we will focus on this one. Okay, so since the boundary is in two dimensions, we can always express the boundary metric as a conformally flat metric and express the Carlton frame like that in these Lightcall coordinates, where we have that phi is the conformal factor and zeta is a function related to the Lorentz boost. Okay, and then we can look for the charges that are associated with the Weyl Lorentz symmetries. And we will see that the Weyl function and its gauge parameter vanish identically. So the Weyl symmetry is pure gauge, while we can see that zeta and its gauge parameter h are unconstrained functions on the boundary data. So this charge is manifestly non-conserved, and this is the avatar of an anomaly in the Lorentz symmetry. And this is confirmed by looking at the on-shell variation of the action evaluated on the bulk diffeomorphism, where we can see that it is the eta that does not preserve the on-shell variation of the action, and therefore disclosing a holographic anomaly, where we can see that the other symmetry parameters vanish, are not present, and therefore are not anomalous. Okay? And so this is the result obtained in the second choice of prescription for the presymplectic potential. And if we had chosen the first prescription, one can obtain the same results that are obtained in the Pfeffermann-Graham gauge. For example, the anomaly in the Weyl symmetry, where we can see that here it is sourced by the curvature of the boundary metric. Okay, while in all cases it is sourced, but it is weighted by the field strength of the Weyl connection. So we can see that we have a displacement of anomaly from Weyl symmetry to Lorentz symmetry. But it is not an issue in itself, since there are just two different representatives in the same cohomology class. And this can be proved by looking at the BST formulation. Okay, now I will say some words on the flat limit. The KID is that in the ADS, we deal with a null radial gauge so that we can take the smooth flat space limit. And in this limit, the time like ADS boundary will be mapped to a null manifold, which is the null infinity of asymptotically flat space time. Okay? And the boundary metric will become degenerate, and therefore the boundary geometry Karolian. Okay? And we can take the flat limit at all the level of what we have seen in ADS. And for example, we can also obtain it for the conformal gauge and express the Karolian dyad in a sort of analog of the conformal gauge of ADS. And we can also look for the charges that are associated with the Weyl Carroll boost symmetries. And in this case, we also obtain that Weyl is pure gauge, where we again have an anomaly in not this time, not in Lorentz symmetry, but in the flat analog of Carroll boost symmetry. Okay? And this is again confirmed by looking at the on-chain variation of evaluated along a bulk diffeomorphism. Okay? And for the moment, the classification of anomalies in BMS3 field theories is missing. There is some example in the literature, But this differs, however, from this result, which is therefore a new graphic prediction calling for further investigation. Okay, now let's make a small summary. So the main goal of this talk was to explore the charges of three-dimension ADS or flat gravity in a more generally covariant bond gauge with respect to boundary deformations, viral rescalings, and local frame boost. Okay? So the first big message is that we have a bigger set of residual symmetries. But when we look at the asymptotic symmetries, we see that they are just boundary and local frame boost. Okay? And the second big message is that we have divergences in the symplectic structure, but we can renormalize it via the built-in ambiguities and discuss the Chauffard charges and anomalies linked to the non-conservation of these charges. And in particular, in the flat limit, one can obtain a new holographic Kaolin prediction. Okay? And I will just say some words, if I have time, on future possibilities of this work. So one first possibility would be to relate these results to the recent developments in the corner proposal via, for example, the so-called asymptotic corner group. It will be also interesting to connect these results obtained in the Kaolin holography to the celestial holographic proposal. And finally, it can be also interesting to extend these results from three dimensions to higher dimensions, where, for example, in four dimensions, the Weyl and Lorentz group are no longer isomorphic. Okay, so thank you for your attention, and if you have any question, feel free to ask.
Thank you. Right, are there questions for Arnaud? I guess the audience is a bit tired. It has been a long day, so. Well, if there are no questions, we can then thank Arnaud again. And we move to the next speaker. So since you're getting tired, let me give you some good news first. So later on, please stay around. There is going to be wine and cheese reception. For non-PI residents, we provide, on top of lunch and coffee breaks, also breakfast and dinner. So you have dinner here at perimeter. Provide means through the black hole. So don't go around and get some dinner and bring receipts, because they will not be accepted. If you go to the black hole bistro and have dinner here, that is covered. Please, one thing about tonight. Let Dan, the manager of the black hole bistro, know before 7 what are your intentions and which dish you would like to have. That's the only requirement for today, all right? Very good. And if that's clear, let's move on. Florian, you are all set, I suppose. So next speaker is Florian Ecker from TU Vienne, and he's going to tell us about DS2 as excitation of ADS2. Thank you.
Yeah, let me also start by thanking Celine and Luca for putting together this nice conference and also for giving me the chance to speak here. So this is based on work done together with Daniel Krumiller and Robert McNeese. And here we've been investigating a certain two-dimensional gravity model exhibiting this feature you can see in the title, and I want to tell you a bit more about this in the next 10 minutes. So just as a general motivation, in 2D Einstein-Hilbert gravity is trivial, so the theories of interest here are dilaton gravity theories, so the dynamical fields here are not just a two-dimensional metric, but also a scalar field. And over the last decades, these models have been a very valuable playground for effects in classical as well as in quantum gravity, for phenomena related to black holes, and for implementations of the holographic principle. So a prominent player there is the Chakiv-Teitelbaum model, for example, which is part of a very explicit implementation with a dual being related to the SYK model. And so here we've been exploring a very specific dilaton gravity model, which I want to define it first, afterwards look at its solution space, and finally come to the thermodynamics, where this interesting feature you saw in the title can be seen. So the model itself can be, is a member of the so-called UV family. That's a very large family of dilaton gravity models, parameterized by two potential functions, U and V. And depending on the choice you make, you can have a different model. So for example, the Jakif Teitelbaum model is given for this choice. Another prominent model, the CJHS model, is used for studying black hole evaporation asymptotically flat space times given by this choice. And the model we've been looking at can be reached by choosing these potentials. So here you can see the potential V is a higher polynomial dependence in the dilaton field. And there's also a negative real parameter B appearing. So actually, this is a one parameter family of models. The model is conformally related to a model studied by Almeri and Polchinski several years ago by the dilaton dependent value scaling. And this means that the equations of motion are actually equivalent. So you can really, it's just a redefinition of variables in this sense, and you can map the solution spaces to each other. However, as soon as you look at thermodynamical properties of the solution space, where you might want to compute on-shell actions and so on, the models will differ. And also, when the models are coupled to metafields, the physical results will be inequivalent, essentially, because geodesics aren't violin-variant. The nice thing about any dilaton gravity model, such as this is one, the classical theory is exactly solvable. So you can really write down all the solutions exactly. And here they are. So we chose a very convenient gauge here. Of course, by this gauge choice, we've killed all the boundary dynamics. So we're only interested in the properties of the bulk solutions here. So these are static coordinates, and you can write the metric in this way. The dilaton depends only on the radius. the solutions are labeled by one constant of motion mu. And already here can be seen the main feature of these solutions. The curvature is constant and state dependent. So depending on the value of mu, you can get either sine or zero for the Ricci curvature. A non-standard feature I have to point out is a non-standard property is that large values of the dilaton are mapped to small values of the radius, as you can see here. And in dilaton gravity theories, one usually interprets the large dilaton region as a weak coupling region where you normally want to impose your boundary conditions and where the dual theory should live. And we take the same viewpoint here. However, this region geometrically does not really correspond to an asymptotic region, as you can see by looking at the line element. So the region R going to zero rather corresponds to an origin of spacetime. So this seems a bit strange at first, but actually this makes it possible for the solutions to share this interior region where the boundary conditions are imposed, but have different asymptotic behaviors geometrically. So this can also be seen by looking at the maximal extended spacetimes. So here you can see different cases with varying mu from left to right, mu decreases. And for mu greater than b squared, the solution has local positive curvature. The static coordinates cover this orange patch you can see here. So it's bounded by a horizon. The asymptotic region where dilaton vanishes is this dashed black line. And the region where we impose our boundary conditions, which corresponds to large values of the dilaton, is this red thick line here. And as mu decreases, we get at some point vanishing curvature with the characteristic null hypersurface for the asymptotic region and also an ADS case. And as soon as mu becomes negative, the horizon vanishes, and the spacetime you get here is just a plain ADS2 spacetime. So as a main step, we want to look at the thermodynamics here, and that's why we impose another boundary condition, fixing the temperature, which is related to the periodicity of Euclidean time. And in the saddle point approximation of the Euclidean path integral, you can relate the free energy to the on-shell action of a given solution. Whenever there is a horizon, so for the solutions exhibiting a horizon, there is an additional regularity condition, which in fact singles out a certain value of mu for a given t, so such that you don't encounter a conical defect. Whereas for the horizonless solutions, such a regularity condition does not exist, and you can basically put them consistently at any temperature. So in a picture of a canonical ensemble, there is always, for a given t, a state with horizon, and a whole continuum of horizonless states, which are consistently continued to Euclidean time. And the free energies can be computed for these solutions. You find that the free energy of the solutions with horizon is always negative, whereas the free energy of the solutions without horizon is always positive. So the picture arises that there is always a ground state solution with a horizon plus a whole continuum of excited states. So I told you before that the actual curvature of the spacetimes depends on the value of mu. And mu, in turn, is fixed in terms of the temperature for the solutions with horizon. So this actually means that the ground state is of type, has positive curvature for high temperatures, whereas it has negative curvature for low temperatures. And this is actually what coins the title of this talk, that the high T phase is dominated by the sitter, low T phase by anti-de sitter. So the sitter is an excitation of anti-de sitter in this sense. So of course, so far this was only the vacuum classical theory, and one might ask whether there is whether this property still remains as soon as you add perturbations. And that's actually what we did in the rest of the paper, and unfortunately I don't have enough time to go through this in detail, but I'm happy to discuss it afterwards. So we looked at non-perturbative and perturbative stability of the solution. We also included a matter field classically as well as quantum mechanically and computed the back reaction on these spacetimes. And it turns out that this picture doesn't change qualitatively, so you can still have this the ground states being dominated by the sitter solution for high temperatures and anti-de sitter for low temperatures. So let me finish by some further directions to look at. So one obvious thing is to maybe relax the boundary conditions and analyze asymptotic symmetries. So far we've really looked at zero mode solutions. Another thing is to maybe look at implementations of the sitter holography. So there has been a recent proposal by Susskind where the sitter space might actually be dual to a high temperature phase of the SVK model. It might be interesting to find out if this model could lead to a specific implementation of this proposal. And also, yeah, whether the model can be related to some high dimensional theory. So far this was intrinsically two dimensional, the viewpoint we took. So yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Come on, Charles, ask your question.
Okay, okay. I'm very, very short. I guess I did not understand. So you solve the equations for which boundary condition? Where do you impose boundary condition in the spacetime?
So the boundary conditions are imposed at the region where the dilaton takes large values. So, okay.
So in the middle of the spacetime.
Yes, geometrically that's a small R region. So when you think of the static patch, for example, of the sitter space, it would be really the origin. So the left or right boundary of the sitter space is actually the region R going to zero, so the center of the static patch, so to say. And that's where we basically place the hypersurface where for the well-defined variational principle, you need to add a boundary action here, which I didn't mention explicitly, but that's where we put this boundary action. Small values of the radius.
Okay. Okay, I'm done.
Please, go ahead. Are there other questions for Florian? All right, then we can thank Florian again. Thank you very much. So before moving on to our last speaker, just an announcement. In principle, there would have been two speakers left, but unfortunately, Christoph Goller didn't manage to come. So we are sorry to inform you that we had to cancel his participation last minute because he's sick. And he comes from LMU, and on the website you could find what the talk title and abstract will be about, just to acknowledge the fact that he was selected to present his work here. And then we can move to the last talk of this gong show by Gloria Odak. How is it going? Oh, you have to fix this, sorry. Yeah, okay, very good. So we can start, okay, right? So we're happy to have Gloria Odak from CPT Marseille. She's gonna tell us about Brown-York charges on null boundaries with alternative boundary conditions. Please, go ahead.
First, I wanna thank the organizers for giving me the opportunity to speak here and also for making us send the presentations 5 days in advance so that all the typos that I found today are still here. So the dependence of gravitational charges on boundary conditions was anticipated already in the Wald saga, in particular in the 95 paper with Iyer, and recent attention around the improved nether charge prescription, which makes the role of the choice of polarization of phase space explicit, has given some new interest to this question. And I'm going to start by introducing really quickly the prescription, because I assume that most people here are very much familiar with it under this or some one of the other 10 names that people give to it. So we are dealing with a Lagrangian that consists of a bulk piece and a boundary piece, and this is the first typo of the series of typos on this slide. I'm missing a D in the boundary term, so this little L is the boundary Lagrangian. And we are exploiting all the ambiguities in the definition of the symplectic potential to write it in this form, which makes explicit the polarization of phase space that it encodes. So another typo, this arrow should go from theta, not theta bulk. And this theta is a form PDQ for some choice of a canonical variable Q. So on shell of boundary conditions, this theta is zero. The second piece is the total variation of the boundary Lagrangian, and the third piece is the corner symplectic potential that this boundary Lagrangian induces. And the nether charge of this bulk boundary combination is also the Hamiltonian charge on shallow boundary conditions, and it's given by this blue expression here. The first term is the bulk nether charge, the second term is going to give us the dependence on the boundary conditions, and the third term contains the corner symplectic potential. So before going to null boundaries, I'm going to quickly go through what happens on non-null boundaries. So we are considering a region of space-time between two space-like slices and with a time-like lateral boundary. The pullback of the Einstein-Hilbert symplectic potential is given by this expression, and the first term here is gonna encode the Dirichlet polarization. So on shell of Dirichlet boundary condition is gonna vanish, and we see that the boundary Lagrangian that we need to add to the action to make the variational principle well-defined needs to kill the second term. So the boundary Lagrangian here is the famous Gibbons-Hawking York term that is equal to 2 times the extrinsic curvature of the boundary. Now, if you want to study different boundary conditions, we do Lagrangian transformation, which is nothing other but the integration by parts in field space to rewrite this first term in terms of the variation of the momentum conjugate to the induced metric. And for the case of Einstein-Hilbert Lagrangian, this choice of boundary conditions requires no boundary Lagrangian. And usually when dealing with partial differential equations, we can fix either Dirichlet or Norman boundary conditions, but we can also fix any linear combination of the two. And one specific linear combination makes sense in this gravitational case, and it was introduced by York. Instead of fixing the induced metric, the whole of it, we fix the conformal induced metric and do the Lagrangian transformation on the conformal factor. Instead of fixing the conformal factor, we fix the conjugate momentum, which is the extrinsic curvature of the boundary, and the boundary Lagrangian that we need in this case is also proportional to the extrinsic curvature, but with a different factor. So all these three types of boundary conditions require boundary Lagrangians that are proportional to K, so we can just introduce this parameter B and B parameterized boundary Lagrangian, and then look what are the results for the charges with these ingredients. And here it is. So the charges in the end depend on this parameter B, and in the case of Dirichlet boundary conditions, we recovered the Brown-York charge, so we called this result B generalized Brown-York charge, because it's generalized. It generalizes Brown-York for different boundary conditions. Now, we can go to null boundaries. So null boundaries are in general interesting in GR, because we know the constraint-free data, so we know what is physics and what is gauge. We also don't have to restrict to conservative boundary conditions. We can study leaky boundary conditions in a non-ambiguous way. But even if we stay, if we stick to conservative boundary conditions, there are still interesting things to study, and we can still see if this change of polarization is going to affect the charges. So again, we have the pullback of the symplectic potential on a null boundary. Here, the null boundary has the normal L. This gamma is the metric induced on 2D space-like cuts of the null boundary. Theta is the expansion, and K is the inaffinity of null generators. The third term here is, we know, thanks to Sachs, pure gauge, so we can forget about it. The last term can also be dealt with in a couple of ways, so we can choose our favorite way and forget about it, and we are interested in the first two terms. We can see that here we have the variation of the metric, so something that looks like Dirichlet boundary conditions. When the metric is fixed, also the expansion is fixed and the volume form is fixed. So to impose Dirichlet boundary conditions here, we need to add a boundary Lagrangian that is going to cancel this variation of the inaffinity. And now, so the boundary Lagrangian is just the inaffinity, which is quite a non-geometric quantity. It depends on arbitrary parametrization of null generators. So now we have two goals here. We want to change polarization. We want to study different boundary conditions to see first if we can find a class of boundary conditions which are going to eliminate this unphysical looking boundary Lagrangian. And also we want to see what happens to the charges similarly to the time-like case. First question is interesting, especially for the people who are interested in what the value of the action is, which is important for the ADS-CFT community who care about the action equals complexity proposal. So for them, this term is particularly problematic, and they get rid of it usually by adding a counter term, which is going to make things transform properly. But we are going to show that we can just change boundary conditions and get rid of it that way. And the second question is interesting because unlike the time-like case, where we recover Brown-York charges in the Dirichlet case, it was shown last year, I think, by Anthony and collaborators, that that's not the case in general on null boundaries. So we wanted to see if we could find different boundary conditions which are going to get rid of this discrepancy. And so here is the summary of the results. So we've seen that for Dirichlet, we have the boundary Lagrangian is proportional to inaffinity, but we found these two types of boundary conditions which get rid of it completely. So there is no boundary Lagrangian required for Neumann type of boundary conditions. And also we can introduce some version of null York boundary conditions which fix the conformal metric and the momentum conjugate to the scale factor, which also don't require boundary Lagrangians. Now we can go to the charges, and we see again that we have this dependence. So the choice of boundary conditions here is encoded in these two parameters B and C, because unlike the time-like case, in the null case, the corner symplectic potential is different in different cases. That's why we have two parameters. And so we have this dependence, but so neither of these cases will eliminate the term that is the discrepancy between Brown-York and this improved Natter charge. So unfortunately, the second question, we couldn't, the answer to the second question was no so far. So summary from the beginning. The answer to the first question is yes. We found a way to get rid of the non-geometric boundary Lagrangian. The second question is, for this set of boundary conditions that we've studied, no, we couldn't get rid of the anomaly discrepancy between the improved Natter charge and the Brown-York charges for now. Yeah, that's it.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Gloria. Questions? Come on, I was waiting for you.
Can you just remind me what C is in that equation? Oh, that affects the charge. Okay.
Okay, very good. Laurent, you have a question, sorry.
Just can you, on the next slide, can you remind a little bit what you mean by this anomaly discrepancy between the improved Noether and Brown and York? And what do you mean by the anomaly? Sorry. Okay. Of the Lagrangian, you mean?
No, the L downstairs.
Of the L downstairs. Okay. And is that is that bothering, surprising? What's your conclusion?
All right. There's a question over there. Please.
Okay. Thank you. I'm just wondering, by non-anomalous diffeos, you mean like just C without that term, right? In the second sentence, you just don't have that term. So I'm just wondering, how big are these? How big are the diffeos that are not anomalous compared to the ones that are anomalous? So all possible diffeos, modulo the ones that are not anomalous, is that finite dimensional or something like that? Okay.
Keep it there. We are, anyway, if there are no more questions, then let's thank Gloria again. Thank you. All right, she was the last speaker of today, so let me thank all of the speakers again for this tremendous beginning of the conference. There's wine and cheese now on the second floor of the Black Hole Bistro where you had lunch. I'll meet you there, and thanks to all of you.